Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have a special episode for you with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell returning for part two of our deep discussion of his new book, The Third Way: The Nazi International, European Union, and Corporate Fascism. In part one, we covered a post-war Nazi underground that rose in world affairs and had deep ties to technology projects like the CERN Hadron Collider. In part two, we'll trace their influence through deep state American politics, the creation of the EU, and the reunification of Germany. Now, Dr. Farrell's done an amazing job of helping us to understand how the post-war Nazi International set up a secret system of finance and covert power societies like the Bilderberg Group. Now he sees them launching Germany into a new Reich, where they can inflict their cult ideology not just on a country, but on a global corporate system. Whose new world order is it anyway? Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, The Rise of the New Reich and Deep State America.
Germany's economy is number five in the world. Germany produces 10% of the world's gross domestic product, a country the size of the state of Texas. Germany produces 10% of the world's GDP with 0.1% of the world's labor force. So in other words, the same strategic problem that we were confronted with under Kaiser Wilhelm and Adolf Hitler is now on steroids.
You know, we spend a great deal of effort on this show trying to unwind the threads that have us staring down an authoritarian trend of state and corporate centralization that is armed with new technology and the greatest control of the media since the American Revolution was started. As we proceed into a 21st century that sees the greatest disparity of power and wealth between a financial and political elite on one side and the average global citizen on the other, we need to engage these questions in a new and open-minded fashion. It's crucial for us to look at the world players on the stage in geopolitics right now and over the last century. Is there a pattern or plan that's coming together now in everything from control of the food supply to invasion of privacy to the harvesting of our financial assets in a secret financial system? This is what we're here to find out.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. Let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Joseph, it's great to have you back on the show. I know part one was fascinating. And here in part two, we're really going to dive in and find those obscured levels of deep state activity.
Yes.
Now, one thing you did in The Third Way was give us a whole new understanding and insight into Senator McCarthy and McCarthyism. Now, he's typically portrayed as a demagogue. You know, he's ultimately what not to be. And in truth, he's probably the ultimate pariah of the political scene. Anytime you hear of a senator getting out of hand, you know, somebody says, it's McCarthyism.
It's McCarthyism.
Right. But McCarthy had some very interesting allies.
Oh, yeah.
And he arises out of the blue from being a very obscure junior senator from Wisconsin. And then suddenly he's on the national scene. You know, he's got a lot of intel, a lot of inside info, and a lot of clout. Now, how did he go from being basically an obscure nobody to being the center of attention in the early 50s?
Well, I think the real story behind that question, there's a hidden question, and that is why he goes on this tour, as everybody knows, from Wheeling to Colorado, then ends up in Reno, and then flies back to Washington, D.C. And supposedly, you know, this is what brings him to national attention, but even then, what he's saying really isn't sinking in, because by the time he gets back to Washington, D.C., there's a little smattering of a press corps, you know, waiting for him. But it's not, you know, the press following him around like would happen in just a few months. He telegraphs President Truman while he's on this tour. You know, he gives this famous Wheeling, West Virginia speech. Where he claims that he has a list of known communist or communist sympathizers in the State Department. Well, it's most likely, and most of the scholars I've read of who he's talking about here, both, you know, pro and anti-McCarthy apologists, seem to think that McCarthy was referring to Truman's own loyalty review board, which I think is very likely, because President Truman himself had set up this loyalty review board to review all of the radicals that were in the FDR administration. So Truman's kind of inheriting a problem from, you know, all of those Roosevelt years, particularly, you know, at the height of World War II, when you had people like Hopkins and Loughlin Curry and so on, lending all of this support to the communist Chinese, to Joseph Stalin, and so on. And this is what McCarthy's targeting.
Uh-huh.
You know, why have you got this review board with these known cases that are being deemed security risks by your own loyalty review board? Why are they still in their positions in the government? And this is his real thing. And he's sending this telegram to Truman. And Truman, of course, reacts as Truman did, you know, how dare this uppity fascist upstart from Wisconsin. And Truman, you know, McCarthy's often lambasted for his rhetoric. I mean, my word, at one point he refers to some Democrats as commie-crats. So the rhetoric is over the top. But Truman, by the same token, is equally over the top in some of his rhetoric. You know, just listen to some of his speeches sometimes. But Truman reacts, you know, with just this absolute horror, because he's got this review board in place and he's dealing with all of these holdovers from the Roosevelt era. And along comes a Republican upstart junior senator from Wisconsin and blows the whole thing into national media.
Right.
I think this is the beginning of the problem.
So basically, President Truman understands the battle that's going on behind the scenes between the post-war Nazis and the communists who are vying for power in deep state America. But he's handling it at his own pace, under the radar, with the Loyalty Review Board and so on. And here comes McCarthy bombastically blowing it for him before he has a chance to really get a handle on it.
In my opinion, to deal with this, you know, adequately and quietly and in a way that's not going to get everybody upset and looking for communists under every rock,
mm-hmm.
Which of course eventually happens. But the other thing that Truman's facing, and I think this may be a part of the story that no one is connected, you've got, of course, all the dirty deals made with the Nazis. You've got Truman's own decision in 47 to use all that Axis loot to fund covert developments. And I think behind the scenes, you've got all of these deals that the White House knows about, that the intelligence community knows about. And what they're trying to forestall is him, meaning McCarthy or anybody else, getting too close to some of these things. So it's a big national security mess.
So now this kind of clandestine investigation hits the front pages, and it's blown wide open. And the people that were being surveilled are now aware that they're under investigation. We have to wonder, in the grand scheme of things, where McCarthy could even have been getting this really high-end intel. So what is it that happens next?
McCarthy gets back to Washington, and the press and everybody else has been pressuring him to name the names that he's talking about on his speeches on the floor of the Senate. And this is where the fun begins. Because McCarthy does get up on the floor of the Senate, I put this in the third way, and he begins a case-by-case review, reading into the Senate congressional record all of these cases. And it's clear he's got information. I mean, he's not just making this up, as he's often accused, off the top of his head. He's giving detailed information about these cases, but he's doing this with numbers. In other words, he's not disclosing the actual names. Mm-hmm. It's the Democrats on the floor of the Senate that are pushing him to reveal the names on the floor of the Senate. And McCarthy refuses to do this. Well, I've got the names. You can come by my office. I'll be glad to give them to the senator, but I am not going to name names, and he's very clever, unless the majority wants me to do so. He's tossing it right back into the lap of the Democratic majority at the time. So he's putting the onus back on them. So eventually they come up with the Tidings Committee under, a huge McCarthy opponent, Millard Tidings,
right,
that more or less tricks Senator McCarthy into naming the names in open session. And once McCarthy reveals the names, then it's all over. McCarthyism has been committed. You know, he's done this in open session. McCarthy himself, when you look at his own behavior, once he has his own committee.
Right, so 1951.
Most of the time he goes into executive session precisely in order to keep this out of the media.
Okay.
So in other words, the image that we have of him recklessly smearing people on public TV using, hiding behind senatorial immunity, this really isn't entirely the entire truth about the man. So you've got all of this stuff. For me, the really interesting point here is not so much that McCarthy is a shameless opportunist. There's no getting around this. This is what he is. He's a junior senator from Wisconsin looking for a national issue. Mm-hmm. What is the interesting question for me is who draws his attention to this list in the State Department? Where does he get this? He's getting this from, he has to be getting it ultimately from a source in the State Department. And he's getting all of these names, I think, as most modern scholarship now agrees, there's some connection between McCarthy's cases and the Venona transcripts that the U.S. Army is, a top secret program to monitor the communications of all of these communist cell apparatuses in this country. And it's clear that some of his cases are coming from this. So he's got sources that to this day have never been explored.
Uh-huh.
So to me, this means that somebody's kind of handing him this issue. And the bigger picture here, as I mentioned to you when we've talked before and kind of privately about all this, the bigger picture for me is that the McCarthy committees are really just only one picture, part of the picture of what's going on in the Congress after World War II. You've got the House Un-American Activities Committee with all of that stuff about Alger Hiss. You've got the Senate committees, McClellan, McCarran, people like this, investigating security risks, investigating the mafia. And, there's Bobby Kennedy and Robert Kennedy right in the thick of that. And then you've got an unknown, virtually unknown set of committees in the House, the Dease Committee and the Reese Committee investigating foundations. And in each of these cases, from McCarthy to the Reese Committee, you've got all of these committees that are pointing out some aspect of the penetration of the federal government. To me, this is the big story.
Right.
It's not just McCarthy. It's not just Reese. It's just not CUAC, it's not just McClellan and McCarran. It's all of these committees taken together. There's this big congressional move to investigate penetration of the federal government by communist mafia, what have you, or manipulation of it by corporate foundations. The real question is, where is this coming from? And I, to this day, Daniel, I may be saying this out of ignorance because, you know, I'm not a professional historian of this particular period of American history. But to this day, I get the impression that no one has sat down to do a scholarly, in-depth study of all of these committees together and figure out why you had this big move in the Congress after World War II to investigate all these things. Clearly, somebody somewhere knows that there's a big problem inside the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the real question for me is, why has no one attempted to connect the dots between all these committees, if there indeed are any dots to connect?
Well, it sounds just like there are.
Oh, yeah. To me, to me, just raising the question in that way indicates to me that there's a big kind of gap in the scholarship of the period. So, you know, it would take literally going through all those congressional records, going through all the records of those committees, you know, which would be an enormous scholarly task. I mean, just the Venona transcripts alone are causing people to go back and reexamine just the McCarthy angle. So imagine trying to expand this to include all of these other committees and what they're investigating. The key figures here, I think, really are the Kennedys.
Well, the Kennedys show up on a number of these crime investigation committees after this. You know, the major committee that went after the mobsters in 1951 was the Kefauver Committee. And that has strange ties to the Kennedys also, because Jack Ruby, a figure in the JFK assassination, is actually an informant for that committee.
Yeah, the Kefauver Committee. Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's another one, you know, that we can stick right in there. The Kennedys are in the thick of this. You know, most people, and I point this out in the book, most people are totally unaware that Robert and John Kennedy had a very close connection to Senator McCarthy. Bobby Kennedy was assistant counsel on his committee. Joseph Kennedy was trying to get him to be the senior counsel. McCarthy chose Roy Cohn.
another heavy hitter.
Another heavy hitter, absolutely. Oh, yeah. But yeah, Bobby Kennedy, as I point out in the book, goes to attend McCarthy's funeral in Appleton, Wisconsin, completely secretly.
And by now, Senator McCarthy's name has already been dragged through the mud.
Oh, this is after the scandal. This is after the Army McCarthy hearings. This is after the censure. You know, when McCarthy dies, in my opinion, it's weird. You know, the steam has gone out of the sails. You know, there's no energy in the locomotive, and McCarthy just kind of falls apart and dies, which I think is a little suspicious. And again, McCarthy's behavior here is unusual, because until Evans came out and said McCarthy gave his papers to Toledano, who gave them to me, nobody knew what happened to McCarthy's papers. I mean, they had just disappeared.
Wow, it's amazing.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff going on even to this day that we're not privy to. But Bobby Kennedy goes to Senator McCarthy's funeral. There were a couple of very weird instances where both of the – I think it was John Kennedy, as a matter of fact, that was at some Harvard do where Ed Murrow, you know, who had done this CBS hit piece on McCarthy – was the guest speaker. John Kennedy got up and said, "How dare you impugn a patriot," meaning McCarthy, like that, and walked out.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the Kennedys were very thick in this process, but by the same token, we need to remember they're very thick in the process of examining the mafia. You know, we've all seen those pictures of the Kennedys grilling Jimmy Hoffa. You know?
Yes, it is fascinating. And we can see that they may be hitting out at something bigger than just organized crime here. They may be targeting this system of black budget finance. But let's take a look at some of the clashes at these hearings.
"Did you say that SOB, I'll break his back?"
"Who?"
"You."
"Say to who?"
to anyone.
If I give you a speech, I don't even know who I was talking about, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Mr. Hoffa, all I'm trying to find out, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm trying to find out whose back you were going to break.
Figure your speech. Figure your speech.
I would be very happy to have our legal counsel here, our legislative representative here, assisting me and spending as much time as necessary to acquaint the American people with the fact that this is a strike-breaking, union-busting bill. In my opinion.
Mr. Hoffa, this bill is not a strike-breaking, union-busting bill. You're the best argument I know for it. Your testimony here this afternoon, your complete indifference to the fact that numerous people who hold responsible positions in your union come before this committee and take the Fifth Amendment because an honest answer might tend to incriminate them. Your complete indifference to it, I think, makes this bill essential.
So they're putting a lot of credibility on the line to get to the bottom of this.
So they're in the thick of this. There's some part of this story here that I think may have yet another Kennedy thing that hasn't been adequately explored yet.
No question, there's some unusual factors coalescing during this period. You know, we have McCarthy coming forward and really blowing the whistle on some of these government secrets and having incredible access to this very sensitive information. And then just a few years later, he's being taken down hard and he's out of the picture.
Right.
But while he's up there, he has RFK as his assistant counsel. And he has JFK's support and JFK being around this process.
In the circle, yeah.
Yeah, and then we have Robert Kennedy going to his funeral. We have JFK defending him publicly. And even when McCarthy is censured by the Senate, JFK abstains from the vote. He actually decides not to be around, and you have that whole story about him being in the hospital.
Yeah, well, JFK, you know, there were 22 senators that voted against the censure measure against Senator McCarthy. And it was the Democrats all voted for it, of course. The Republicans were kind of split right down the line. So you had 22 Republican senators that voted against the censure measure. I'm from South Dakota, and our senior senator at the time, Senator Munt, well known, you know, at that period in history, voted against the measure. John Kennedy, who was the junior senator of Massachusetts at the time, was absent from the vote. He was conveniently in the hospital for back surgery. And, you know, it's very clear that Kennedy did not want to be present on the floor and have to vote against, you know, to keep his party loyalty and at the same time vote against, you know, someone that his family had supported so strongly. You know, Joseph Kennedy's giving money to McCarthy.
Right.
Know? So Kennedy, John Kennedy, is in a very difficult position. So he conveniently schedules back surgery so that he doesn't have to be there during the censure vote. And, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt is still alive at the time, you know, the grand old dame of, you know, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And so she's constantly going after John Kennedy to force him to come out one way or the other, you know, in favor of the censure or against the censure. And finally, Kennedy has to say, well, you know, I was in favor of the censure. But even then, Kennedy soft pedals that. But the censure does not imply that I was against any of McCarthy's policies.
All right.
Well, you know, it's a typical politician statement just to get Eleanor Roosevelt to shut up about it. You know?
And we can't really call her a Kennedy supporter.
No, we can't.
Yeah, no. Which is interesting in itself. Now, Kennedy has some really deep contacts, even when he's a senator.
Yes.
And the fact that he was standing by McCarthy during all this tells us something, that he believed McCarthy's investigations of exposing communists infiltrating the State Department was valid. So we have a couple of interesting strains now from your work that we could look at here. You know, you've got these post-war Nazis integrating into the U.S. government, into NASA, into the financial realms, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have this wave of communists, which you call commies in the rosy fields of FDR.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So we could be looking at a power struggle behind the scenes there of these communists infiltrating the government of America, and then these post-war Nazi elements getting assimilated. And these two forces are squaring off once again, but inside the new umbrella of the post-World War II American empire.
Yeah. I think that there's some element, let's put it this way, I have no evidence to this other than the very as you pointed out, this very peculiar fact that you had these very radical, very obviously sympathetic, communist sympathetic people within Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And it's not just McCarthy pointing this out, it's a number of people pointing this out. And you've got that element. Then you've got, under Truman, you've got this Operation Paperclip deal, which again, Truman, let's be honest here, Truman absolutely forbade by executive order the importation of anybody with known or suspected Nazi sympathies, and the military just simply ignored him.
Right. I know. How else can we explain that? He said in his order that we're not going to have them here. Then we have a huge number of them. Obviously, they just ignored him on this.
Yeah, they did. And I suspect, as you suspect, that behind the scenes there may be taking place behind the umbrella of all these congressional investigations. I suspect that there's some sort of hidden warfare going on between these pro-communist and pro-Nazi factions.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really understands this. I don't think McCarthy understood it because, you know, McCarthy had his own kind of proto-fascist sympathies. I don't know what else to call them. But you had all of these things going on in the background that I suspect are fueling some of this and driving some of it. And at the point that McCarthy starts getting too close to the Nazi angle, that may be the point at which they decide, you know, we got to shut this guy down because if he finds this out, you know, he's really going to go ballistic.
Right, right. So he was just too good of a researcher.
He was too good of a researcher. You know, the guy's a lawyer. He was a sitting judge. So, you know, when you actually read the transcripts of some of his committee hearings, you know, they're rather dull because he's asking questions like a lawyer and very carefully leading people to where he wants to get them. And then finally, yeah, they say, well, I refuse to comment, decline to comment on the grounds that might tend to incriminate me. And he says, okay, fine, let's move to the next case, you know. So he gets them to that point. He's very clever the way he does this. And most of his committee members, Munt McLaren or McClellan, I forget which was the Democrat on his committees, that was always, you know, Henry Jackson, you know, Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington. He's another one of these members of McCarthy's committee. Most people forget this. So I think you've got some sort of factional infighting that could be going on. But as I want to be very clear here, as of now, this is kind of a lurking, lingering intuition that I have. I don't have any evidence that I can put forward as an argument to make that case. But like I say, this is why this period of American history really needs some detailed, focused attention, I think, by the alternative community to look at all these investigative committees and see just why this sort of suddenly arose out of World War II,
mm-hmm.
and what dots may be there to connect between all of this, you know. And let's not forget, squatting in the center of the CIA at the time is our dear friend, that wonderful fellow Alan Dulles.
All right,
you know, and the whole Sullivan and Cromwell crowd. Well, this is another part of the story. Because, the Sullivan and Cromwell crowd, Alan Dulles, William McKittrick, all of these people were secretly trying to negotiate, you know, during the latter half of World War II with the Nazis to end, you know, to end the war in the West so that the Nazis could concentrate on the Soviets. And Roosevelt gets wind of this. You know, Morgenthau, Harry Dexter White, people like this, they all get wind of this and shut it down. So there's even in the Roosevelt era, there's this tremendous factional infighting between the power structures in this country on the radical left and on the radical right. And, you know, this carries over. There's something of this going on. And that's why I think you do have a case that might be made for this kind of factional infighting carrying on into the McCarthy era behind the scenes. But
that's what it appears to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can easily envision a scenario where these post-war Nazi underground forces are feeding this highly sensitive information to McCarthy to out all the communists because it will strengthen their position.
Sure.
And like you're saying, he goes a little too far and stumbles into their connections, and they move to get him out of there now that he's done his job.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that leads me to suspect that. One of McCarthy's most infamous, and I think justifiably infamous, episodes was when he attacked Secretary Marshall, General Marshall, on the floor of the Senate in a very lengthy speech questioning his integrity for having invaded southern France. You know, we had the big D-Day landings, but nobody remembers we had an equally huge military operation invading southern France about 3 months later around Marseille, Toulon, places like that, which from a purely, and this was McCarthy's point, which from a purely military point of view was totally unnecessary.
Huh.
And that raises the question then, well, why did we invade southern France? You know, and McCarthy never really latches into the importance of the questions he's raising. Forget about the personal attacks on Marshall. Why did we do that?
Yeah.
And to my way of thinking, you know, doing all this stuff on Nazis, you had all those SS excavations going on, guess where, in southern France at this time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, under the personal leadership of Heinrich Himmler, going down to the Languedoc around Rennes-le-Château, of all places, to uncover something. And this is being led by, guess who, Otto Skorzeny.
So they're looking for Templar artifacts.
They're looking for, I think they're looking for something that has to do with the Albigensians, the Templars, and U.S. intelligence gets wind of this, and, you know, we're going to invade southern France.
Right.
And none of this comes out, of course, and McCarthy's getting close to it, and, you know, once the attack on Marshall's made, the media has a field day with McCarthy. You know, how dare you go after this? Well, I think the field day that they're having is a deliberately orchestrated campaign because they want to shut that line of inquiry down.
Oh, yeah. Now, McCarthy is the bull in the china shop, and God knows what he's going to reveal. Let's take a look at this clip to get a sense of the tension at some of these hearings. And some of that ferocity is turning now back at McCarthy. And his enablers and the deep state are definitely getting ready to cut the cord.
The charge by the junior senator from Wisconsin that we've had another year of treason under President Eisenhower. The charge that the CIA is infiltrated, infested with communists.
Anyone who has followed the communist conspiracy, even remotely, and who can add two and two, we'll tell you that there is no remote possibility of this war which we're in today, and it's a war which we've been losing, no remote possibility of this ending except by victory or by death for this civilization.
I repeat, they can see how low an alleged man can sink. He's been asked here to come before the committee and give the information which he has in regard to this investigation. The Vice President.
Sign the letter.
I will not sign the letter with false
statements. Sign the letter. Very simple. In the record.
Mr. Senator,
all
Senator,
you have to do is sign it.
Don't pull that. Don't pull that phony thing on me.
Sign the letter. There it is, Senator. Got my signature on it.
You have a document with false statements in it. I will not sign and agree that's true. I don't. You're not fooling anyone, Mr. Simington.
Pretty heavy, heavy stuff. Now, Joseph, I'm curious about the reasons for this southern France invasion. So can we go a little further into that? I guess my question is, how would this operation have come into play under the cover of war?
You know, it's pretty convenient when you stop and think about it. That if you want to transfer whatever you may have found in southern France and get it out of Europe. Well, the easy way to do it is have the Americans invade and just kind of secretly hand it over to them. And that's, you know, that's one scenario.
Well, we have a modern version of this with the Iraq War and the looting of the Baghdad Museum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. I do feel like there's a lot in this FDR part of the story. So I want to bring us into the Harry Hopkins revelations. And the way he shows up with the Major Jordan diaries, that whole period, what was it that was happening there?
Yeah, what is it that's going on there? Good question.
Well, he's his top aide. He's his right-hand man.
Harry Hopkins is a top aide to Franklin Roosevelt. And Major George Racy Jordan was the American U.S. Army Air Force commander at the air base in Great Falls, Montana, that was part of the air lend-lease airlift from the United States to the Soviet Union. They would bring a bunch of supplies to Great Falls, fly them up to Alaska. They would be turned either starting with Russian pilots at Great Falls or Russian pilots in Alaska, and then they'd fly over the Bering Strait into Siberia, and the Russian pilots would carry this stuff on into the Soviet Union. Well, Major Jordan one day is approached by the Soviet liaison officer, I forget what his name was, Soviet Air Force colonel, and told that, you know, we're expecting this really important shipment. Make sure you put a guard on it, but don't look at it. You know. And of course, Jordan has been noticing strange stuff already when the Soviet air crews would fly into Great Falls and disgorge a bunch of Russians from the airplanes, who would promptly run off the airfield, you know, just completely disappear into the woodwork, you know, into the countryside. And Jordan's taking all this down. So he decides, well, Russians or no Russians, I'm going to look inside these shipments. And he does, and he takes notes, and I reproduce his handwritten notes in the book so that you can see that this guy is probably telling the truth, okay? He, in his handwritten notes, he opens up some of these suitcases that have been, you know, stamped with wax, do not open seals, and so on. He opens up some of these suitcases and reads documents that are talking about things like uranium and neutrons and enrichment. And, you know, stuff like this that he's never heard
now,
about.
Now, what year was this happening?
This is about 43.
Okay.
43, 44.
So it's 2 years before we set off an atom bomb.
Atom bomb, right. And, of course, he's not got a clue as to what all this is about. When the Russians find out that he's opened these, they go ballistic. And in one of the notes that he finds in these bags, it's a document that had come directly from H.H., Harry Hopkins, okay? And it was the White House copy of some of these, you know, uranium and deuterium and all of this stuff.
Wow.
So only after the war does Jordan put it together. You know, we were smuggling atomic bomb secrets from the president's advisor with his permission to Soviet Russia. And Jordan gets up, he's called to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He gives his testimony there to guess who? Richard Nixon. You know, and I reproduce this in the book. Nixon asking Jordan all these questions. And of course McCarthy hears about this. You know, this is all part of the deep communist conspiracy going on inside the White House. Well, it is rather suspicious that, you know, we're shipping atomic bomb secrets to Joseph Stalin in the middle of the war, with Harry Hopkins' permission. I think that's suspicious.
Yeah.
I don't blame McCarthy or Nixon for thinking it's a little suspicious.
Definitely.
So anyway, yeah, Jordan is part of it. And of course, Harry Hopkins will come up in McCarthy's numerous speeches as people that were involved with this. Lachlan Curry, all of these people, you know, are mentioned. And they were people that were promoted into positions of power precisely by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So yeah, it's a very, very suspicious story that, you know, we're shipping A-bomb secrets to the Soviets, and then you look at my research and I think the Nazis are helping ship atomic bomb secrets to us. So, you know, it's just this one big incestuous circle of treason, and you know.
Well, FDR and his people, they don't want the Soviets to fall to the Nazis. You know, they make the military aid to the Soviets right. the top priority, even over our own bases. I think you pointed that out,
right?
Which is pretty intriguing.
Well, it is interesting, but in a certain sense, it's entirely understandable. Because, you know, we have the idea in the West that America won World War II. Well, I'm sorry, folks, this is not true. The Soviet Union won World War II.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why is if you look at the sheer scale of operations that both Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany were waging on the Eastern Front, it is absolutely mind-boggling. We had a front, quite literally, that ran from the Arctic Circle to the Black Sea, and at one time, the Caucasus. These were enormous military operations that dwarfed, and I mean dwarfed, anything that the United States or United Kingdom did on the Western Front. Had Nazi Germany been successful, in other words, in taking the Soviet Union out of the war, which it could have done, and everybody knew this, it would have presented an almost insurmountable military obstacle for the Western allies to overcome on their own.
Yeah.
It just could not have been done, quite frankly. So I think in that sense, the Roosevelt administration absolutely took the correct military decision. It may look treasonous. It may look dubious. But in the final analysis, if the Soviet Union fell or even capitulated and offered terms of a negotiated peace with the Nazis, that would have been it. Game, set, match. It's over. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no way the Western allies on their own could have successfully prosecuted that war. You know, with all of America's – and I know that challenges orthodoxy with all of America's industrial might and so on. Well, you know, we forget that Nazi Germany had industrial might too, and quite a lot of it.
Yes.
I think in retrospect, it's easy to criticize Franklin Roosevelt and his advisors for that decision. But had I been there, I would have done the same thing. This is absolutely the number one military priority of the moment. In 1942, when Roosevelt makes that order, the Germans, you know, have just launched another gigantic offensive on the Eastern Front, and they're rolling in, you know, rolling towards the Caucasus oil fields.
So we have to get super tight with Russia and do anything we can to yeah. stop that Nazi advance. Now, the interesting thing is, in your research, you've pointed out that it's quite possible that the Germans were deploying a kind of tactical nuke on the battlefield on the Eastern Front. So the fact that we're shipping uranium and nuclear-style materials to the Soviets to try and defend mm-hmm. them from the Nazis mm-hmm. makes a little more sense if we can get just an idea of that desperation they were having to prevent Russia from falling to Hitler.
Sure. I've presented information in my books that suggests that the Nazis, it has never been, to my mind, conclusively proven, but it is clear, we can say that the Nazis were using something on the Eastern Front, be it dirty bombs, primitive fuel air bombs or thermobaric bombs, whatever you want to call them.
So some exotic technology, some weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, they were using weapons of mass destruction of some sort on the Eastern Front. This is the only way, to my mind, that you can account for the tremendous kill ratio. And I hate to be so blunt and brutal about it, but that's quite frankly what we're talking about. That the Wehrmacht had on the Eastern Front right up to the end of the war. You know, you're looking at a Red Army expenditure of soldiers and equipment that are at approximately a 10-to-1 ratio against the Nazis.
Whoa.
You know, if you wonder why that war took so long and was so bloody, that's one key signal right there. And that any competent military analyst or tactician will tell you, for the conventional warfare at the time, as good as and competent as the German army was tactically, this is way beyond any sort of real operational capability. The Russians would have to have been completely tactically incompetent, which they were not, of course. So to inflict that kind of casualty, yeah, the Germans are doing something on the Eastern Front that we've never really latched on to inflict that kind of slaughter on the Russians.
That's fascinating. And when you think about it, they have such an amazing advance in the first 6 weeks that it's really a historical rout.
Oh, yeah.
And when we think on that level of devastation, the world had probably never seen anything like it.
You're right. There has never been the equivalent in military history anywhere of an advance and a slaughter on the scale that the German armed forces inflicted on the Soviets in those first 6 weeks of the war. It was absolutely unparalleled.
Absolutely. And that leaves even more questions about why, if the Nazis possessed nuclear weapons, didn't they use them later in the war to turn the tides in favor of Germany for a Nazi victory? And were they planning on developing an even greater weapon with the help of an unusual torsion physics project called the Bell? And finally, did this project end up in South America under a new Reich with Nazi official Martin Bormann at the helm? And did this version start laying out a new game plan with a strange document called the Madrid Circular? We're heading into unknown landscape here, and when we come back, you'll find out why. Stay with us. We'll be back with Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount, available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, I say little saucer, it was a saucer, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
We need to engage these questions in a new and open-minded fashion.
Hidden technology.
In other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption because it is literally... it is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors along with everything else into every human body, every animal body.
For more interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist. The truth is never easy.
I hope you're enjoying this fascinating part two episode with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. I wanted to take a moment here to say thank you to our YouTube subscribers for helping us reach over 2 million views recently. I also want to thank the viewers at fktv.is or Forbidden Knowledge TV for making our part one episode the biggest video of the month. One very special treat we have planned for the month of March is having the influential author and publisher of the fktv.is website, Alexandra Bruce, on the show. More details later on that. And thanks a million, times two. And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, the author of the Giza Death Star book series. His latest book, The Third Way, The Nazi International, European Union, and Corporate Fascism, is an excellent window on where that Nazi power base migrated to after the war, and its involvement with the setting up of the EU and the CERN Hadron Collider Project. There's also quite a bit in there about deep state American politics and some unanswered questions about the McCarthy, FDR, and JFK eras. Just fascinating reading. Now, Joseph, let's pick up the thread where we were, getting into World War II. And one persistent rumor is that after the early Nazi victories, Russian leader Joseph Stalin attempts to sue for peace with Hitler through back channels. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. This is done at, I think, at least two times during World War II. The first time is in August of 1941, and that's a key date because by August of 1941, the first phase of Operation Barbarossa is over. 60% of the Red Army has absolutely been liquidated. Russia is reeling from the blows. The Russian Air Force has been wiped out on the ground. They have no air cover whatsoever, which allows the Luftwaffe to just basically roam free. They have nothing, basically. They are on the ropes. And it's at this juncture two things happen. Stalin offers a settlement to Hitler to allow Hitler his living space. He will give Hitler the Ukraine in west of the Dnieper River. He will give them the west of the Dnieper River, Belorussia, and the Baltic states. In other words, Stalin is offering Hitler what Kaiser Wilhelm got from the Russians during the surrender in World War I.
Wow.
He's offering all that back to Hitler, okay? And Hitler, is kind of at this point a victim of his own success. He says, no, we're going to go for the whole thing. We want all of European Russia, no questions asked. Move your capital to Novorossiysk or someplace, but we want it all.
Nice guy.
Yeah, exactly. At that same juncture, Hitler, he's got the second and third Panzer armies, Hoth and Guderian, are now about 250 miles away from Moscow in August with, a few Russian rifle divisions in front of them, which, they can brush aside easily and go for the communications industrial jugular of the Soviet Union. Well, Hitler gets the brilliant idea in his noggin that, all of this trouble that we're having down around Kiev, that'll threaten our flanks, blah, blah, blah. We need to turn Guderian 650 miles south to surround those forces, which he does, over the howls of protestation from his own generals, including Guderian. And basically what Hitler does at this point is, as anybody will tell you, he does two things. He takes the momentum. He knocks the wind out of his own sails. And secondly, a move like that, Barbarossa, was a carefully planned logistical operation. So in other words, the Germans were set up logistically to prosecute that war and put their armies in Moscow before the winters. They had their logistical operation set up to do this. Hitler has just now thrown a huge monkey wrench into the whole thing and said, no, I'm canceling all those careful timetables that you generals have worked out. We're turning an entire Panzer army 650 miles south, imagine being the German quartermaster generals, saying, okay, we're now going to have to take that 250,000 transport pool that we have and all those railroad workers and reconfigure the whole thing. Oof. Just to, this is what costs Operation Barbarossa its success. Then again, in 1942, at the beginning of the German offensives, which, Soviet resistance just kind of evaporates on the Southern Front, and Hitler's armies are rolling forward. Again, Stalin offers basically the same terms to Hitler, and again through Sweden, and again Hitler turns it down.
Mm.
He's a victim of his own success.
Fascinating. Is that the real turning point on the Eastern Front with the war, where he gets far too arrogant, and then there's the loss at Stalingrad? After that, they start to see him as not so invincible after all anymore.
Right. What happened in Operation Blue, which was the 1942 German offensive, Hitler's initial goal was to take the 4th Panzer Army, von Kleist's Panzer Army, and send it down into the Caucasus to the Maykop-Baku oil fields and literally choke Russia of the oil it needed to prosecute the war, and by the same token, give him the oil he needed to prosecute the war. And had he done this successfully, he would have been sitting right on top of Persia, you know, the Arabian Peninsula. You know, this is basically now open territory. Mm-hmm. What he did, however, as the offensive is proceeding forward, as he did so many times in the war, he split objectives and therefore splits the main force that he had originally delegated to the Caucasus to go in two directions, one for Stalingrad, the prestige name and so on, and then the other to the Caucasus. And the German strength simply wasn't sufficient to accomplish both objectives.
Right.
And they fail in both, obviously. What saved Hitler's behind was after Stalingrad, when the Sixth Army is surrounded there, the Russians were on a full front-wide offensive in the Caucasus and in the eastern Ukraine to literally encircle all of Army Group South, not just the Sixth Army, but, you know, just literally collapse the entire southern wing of the German front. The plan was very clear what Stalin was after. He was making a big, huge sweep towards Kiev and then down to the Black Sea to pin, you know, about 2 million Germans against the Black Sea. And that whole plan fell apart because Hitler, in one of his few good decisions, turned the operations over to Field Marshal von Manstein. And von Manstein was, you know, a very, very cool, brilliant tactician, and he completely eradicated four Soviet armies, the part of the story you never hear about, in his counteroffensive. So the Germans lost one army, the Soviets lost four, and we're back essentially to the starting line that we were at in the beginning of 1942.
Wow, mm-hmm. Incredible. This clash of worlds mm-hmm. and the awe-inspiring blitz of the Nazi attacks is phenomenal. So we know what happens after this. The tides turn against Germany over the next couple of years. And by 1945, the Germans lose the war. But the Nazi Party, interestingly enough, survives, which we can see through your research. And there are some intriguing leads there. But some signs start to pop up to indicate that this is happening. And one of them is this unusual document that appears, and it's called the Madrid Circular, which you bring to light in the third way. And it has this theme that basically the war never stopped.
Right. Yeah. For us, the war never stopped. That's a direct quotation.
So my first question on this is, who do you think is putting it out?
Good question. The Madrid Circular is a document that appears in all of its full-blown, paranoid, over-the-top, grandiose Nazi glory in 1950. That's when the document is dated, okay?
Okay.
The document does not exist anywhere else other than in a book published by a German Jewish emigre to the United States by the name of T.H. Tetens, all right, T-E-T-E-N-S. And the book is published in a book that, interestingly enough, is called Germany Plots with the Kremlin in the year 1953, okay? Huh. So the earliest provenance we have for this document is this one book which reproduces the whole thing in the year 1953. And this is why I included it in the book, because even if it's not an authentic document, which I think it is, it's the very fact that you have something so early being laid out in such detail that what the Nazis are going to do, and it's spelled out, I can't spell it out any more explicitly, is use the American dollar diplomacy, is what they call it, against the United States and create all of these conflicts all over the world so that the United States and Soviet Union exhaust themselves in the process, while at the same time, they're going to create a European Federation, which the Germans can dominate because they're the largest economic and political power in Europe. Oh, duh. You know? And if this is sounding familiar, well, that's because it is.
It sounds very modern somehow.
Exactly. You know, you read the Madrid Circular. I didn't even reproduce all of it in the book. I was tempted to. But you read the Madrid Circular and you're just thinking, oh, my God, this is today. It's quite literally a blueprint for the European Federation led by, you know, an economically, politically resurgent Germany. And Tatens, you know, the interesting thing is Tatens is not making this up, because as I point out in the book, in 1942, there's a Reichsbank study led by the German economics minister, Walter Funk, and a bunch of academic experts figuring out, well, how are we going to create the what they call the Großraum Kartell in German, the large space cartel, meaning IG Farben. Okay, this is a joint Nazi IG Farben study, and it's all about how are we going to set up a post-war European Federation with Germany in charge of it. And, well, one of the interesting things that they decide they're going to do is, okay, we're going to create a Reichsmark zone where every nation that we've conquered or put in puppet governments can keep their own currency, pass their own laws, do what they want to do, just so long as their currency is pegged to the Reichsmark.
Huh.
Okay? Now, and they even create the idea that national currencies will be allowed to fluctuate within this currency zone within certain marginal percentages. And if they stray outside of that, of course, the Reichsbank steps in and adjusts the currency rate. So in other words, they're playing for a Reichsmark reserve currency, basically, is what they're doing in all of Europe, which, of course, leaves Germany in charge of the whole thing. And guess what? Lo and behold, after the war, Chancellor Schmidt and the French president, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, negotiate a deal so that the French can be brought into what had already been put into place as kind of a small version of the 1942 Nazi plan. It was called the exchange rate mechanism, where a bunch of small countries like Holland, Denmark, Austria, and so on, had their currencies pegged to the Deutschmark. And the big key came when d'Estaing and Schmidt negotiated the French entry into that mechanism. So what this meant was from the end of the 1980s up until the creation of the euro. This is so important for people to understand.
All right.
The exchange rate mechanism had the French franc coupled to the German D-mark. And it was the German Bundesbank that would have to step in and adjust the rates if the French franc fluctuated outside those margins.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, this gave the Germans an enormous amount of control over the French economy behind the scenes. And when the French foreign minister and French economics minister spilled the beans, this is, you know, I even put this in the book, when they spilled the beans, that was it. For the exchange rate mechanism, because now the French and the Germans had to go to a common currency, which eventually happened when they negotiated the euro. So this is all what I'm getting at here, folks. This is all coming out of Nazi plans for Europe laid in 1942,
wow.
And they're talked about in the Madrid Circular. It's just crystal clear.
Phenomenal. It is really amazing. And you've pointed out before that the reunification of Germany in 1990 had an even bigger impact than we realize. Also, it happened so fast.
Suspiciously fast.
Right. Suddenly, Kohl shows up on the scene, and he has a plan for reunification.
Boom, there we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you look at that, and we fast forward to today, with Germany's economy zooming, how did they do it?
Hang on. Germany's economy is number 5 in the world.
Whoa.
Germany produces 10% of the world's gross domestic product. A country the size of the state of Texas, okay, is producing 10% of the world's GDP with 0.1% of the world's labor force. So in other words, the same strategic problem that we were confronted with under Kaiser Wilhelm and Adolf Hitler is now on steroids. You've got this enormous economy, you know, which if you stop and think about what that means, enormous economies equal military potential. Okay. So in other words, if they wanted to rearm themselves to the teeth, they could do it in a heartbeat. Okay.
Right.
And all of this is going on top of a very narrow labor base and no strategic resources whatsoever. So, you know, the whole strategic nightmare of Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany is being repeated now on this grand scale. The only thing that's different is Germany's position in the European Union able to dominate it. All right. That's the key thing here.
So there is some hidden aspect to this reunification.
The reunification, what people don't understand, and I cover this in the Nazi International, is Kohl, let's just be honest here, Kohl's a snake in the grass. I mean, this guy is a serpent.
Okay. Don't hold back, Joseph.
Don't hold back. This guy's a piece of work. I mean, you know, he's just straight out of Nazi casting central here. But when East Germany begins to have the protests that take place in East Germany, initially, the people in East Germany simply want a reform of the system. They're not talking about reunification with the West or anything at all. And what then begins to happen is, oddly enough, extremely right-wing cells, let's just use that term for the moment, but we really know what they are, but they're extremely right-wing cells in East Germany, communist East Germany. So stop and ask yourself this. How do you have extreme right-wing cells surviving in a totalitarian police state, unbelievable, like East Germany, suddenly crawling out of the woodwork, going to all these rallies and beginning to drive the movement for reform in East Germany into a movement for reunification. This is very, and they're showing up with cell phones, computer programs, lots and lots of money. So in other words, I suspect that this whole thing has been that long-term Reinhardt-Galen rollback scenario, because clearly these cells have a connection to the German West German BND, which was, guess what, Galen's old outfit rolled into West German intelligence. So all this is going, and then Kohl makes this, and you just got to hand it to the guy. This is just brilliant. He says, well, you know, okay, We could let you guys back into the, you know, one big happy reunited Reich again. But, you know, there's this little currency problem and all of your inefficient state industries. And if we were to do this, my word, you know, open the borders, well, all you poor East Germans would come flooding into West Germany, and we can't have that. So what did he do? He offered, this was so brilliant, he offered to tender, and remember, the D-mark at this time is part of the exchange rate mechanism, which now includes France. Okay. So he says, well, what we're going to do is we will tender par value West German D-marks for East German marks. Turn in your currency and we'll swap it at par value. So in other words, the East German Deutschmark, which had been worth about a tenth of the West German D-mark, is traded at one-on-one paper value. So he wipes out the East German currency. He keeps all those East Germans in place, and they can now go to West Germany and buy lots of goods and so on and so forth. So basically, he simply sucks the East German economy into a union with West Germany, and by that point, it's all over. The East Germans have lost their state. They, you know, they can't run it. It's all being run out of Bonn. So, you know, and this was a plan just to tweak everybody's interest a little more. This was a plan that had been put together by a fellow by the name of Günter Strassmayr, who was a German member of the Bundestag in Kohl's party. He was the minister without portfolio that was in charge of creating this plan of how to basically annex East Germany without anybody really raising any ruckus, okay?
All right.
This fellow Günther Strassmayr is the father of Andreas Strassmayr, who, if you know the story of the Oklahoma City bombing, is the German, Andy the German, that is a close friend of Tim McVeigh.
Oh, right.
And he's the guy that was the security chief for that right-wing militia thing in Roland, Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
And it's Andreas Strassmayr, who was, you know, Günther Strassmayr's son, who was a graduate of Germany's Hanover War Academy, a captain in the Panzergrenadiers in the Bundeswehr, in the German army, who's over here doing all of this stuff. And once, you know, he's captured by Oklahoma state troopers, put into a jail for having a car with no license plate. The local sheriff is getting calls from Governor Keating of Oklahoma, a couple of Pentagon generals saying, you've got to release this guy right away. He has diplomatic immunity. So they release him. And then the FBI puts out a BOLO alert for the guy, you know, nationwide. We want to find Andreas Strassmayr. And he turns back up in Berlin at his father's, just in time for the reunification, by the way.
Amazing.
And how did he get out of the United States? Well, good old Chancellor Kohl activated the German GSG-9, their special commando counterterrorism unit, into this country to get him out.
Huh. So, this guy is major.
Yeah, this guy Cole is quite a piece of work, let me tell you.
What was this guy even doing in America anyway?
No one knows. Ostensibly, the cover story is he came over here to be a Civil War reenactor.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
That's a terrible cover.
I'm not kidding. You know, what was
the tie with McVeigh, though? That's just off the charts.
The tie with McVeigh is off the charts. And the official, semi-official story was he was helping the FBI track down American neo-Nazi groups.
Oh.
While at the same time, you know, Cole's obviously sponsoring them to help drive it. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that is fascinating. And I'm really glad you brought that in. So we can see now that this really is the fascist phoenix rising from the ashes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, people, including me, have asked you with all of your research over the years on the post-war Nazi underground, where did they go? And in the third way, you're really saying that they're in the planning forces that set up the European Union.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's very significant. One thing before we leave Chancellor Kohl's story is a strange secret pact that you mentioned between Gorbachev and Kohl that doesn't quite add up. Now, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I talk in the third way about suspicions that were being aired as all this is going down. You know, imagine yourself, you know, your average German or Frenchman or Czech, and you're looking at all this going down. And you're thinking, you know, this has a peculiar feel to it. You know, where have we seen this script before? You know, and the Czechs in particular were so alarmed because, you know, shortly after the reunification, what does Kohl turn around and do? It's Kohl. It's not Bill Clinton. It's Helmut Kohl that begins the disintegration of Yugoslavia by recognizing Croatia.
Huh.
And their independence from you know, Greater Serbia. And, you know, where have we heard this before? Can you think of Ustashi in the 1940s and the puppet government, fascist government, that was so bad even the Nazis complained about it?
You know? All right.
So, you know, it was just over the top. And you know, it's not a good thing to be going around killing Serbian Orthodox Christians when you're trying to get Orthodox Romania to fight against the Russians with you. So,
right.
You know. Kohl turns around. He recognizes Croatia. And in a first that just kind of stunned everybody, I think, he says, oh, yeah, I'll send German peacekeepers to Croatia to make sure those Serbs don't bother you. So he sends a couple of regiments of Panzergrenadiers. He sends a squadron of Luftwaffe fighters. And everybody in Europe is going, what's going on? And then after this is done, he puts the screws to Czechoslovakia. It's Helmut Kohl that cracks up Czechoslovakia. And the Czechs in Bohemia are thinking, oh my word, we're going to become another Reich protectorate, Böhmen und Mähren, Bohemia and Moravia again. And they're writing about this openly in the Czech newspapers. And Kohl just very bluntly tells them, okay, if you want to be in the European Union, if you want to, you know, have a functioning economy, you allow us to do this or else we're just going to keep you out. So, you know, the Czechs have to capitulate. Well, where have we heard this again? You know? Is this 1939 or is it Memorex, you know?
Right.
but anyway, as all this is going down, the Czechs publish in the Prague newspapers rumors of a secret deal between Gorbachev and Kohl, and they publish this thing. And it's in light of what happens in Eastern Europe when the Warsaw Pact collapses, what the Czechs publish is truly stunning. Because according to the deal, the Germans are demanding, if you read it, the Germans are demanding that the Soviet Union retire essentially behind the Pripyat Marshes, which would be basically the pre-World War II borders between the Soviet Union and Poland. Okay.
All right.
And that, you know, once they do that, Germany undertakes, you know, not to expand into any of these areas and so on and so forth. In other words, they're carving up the pie again. And it's the Germans, oddly enough, that are making the demands. And the Soviet Union, you read this thing, is we're consenting to this.
Aha. Uh-huh. So they're dictating the terms.
They're dictating the terms. Yeah.
It's 50 years later and we're back.
And we're back. And back with what, I'm wondering, you know, because we have, you know, the German army is, what, about 250,000 people. You know, they've got a dinky little navy with some really cool U-boats. And,
right, know, right.
And which they're selling to Israel. But anyway, you know, it's just kooky. But, you know, it's not, supposedly, it's not a nuclear power, which makes you wonder, where is the tone coming from? But it's not just the unrealistic tone of the document. It's what the document says specifically regarding Eastern Europe, which has happened. This is the peculiar thing. And so the Czechs are publishing this in Prague, and of course nobody's listening to them, just like they weren't being listened to in 1938 either, you know.
True.
But all of this is happening, and my question is, what were the Soviets scared of? What is giving, if this document be true, and assume for the sake of argument that it is, because clearly, even without this document, clearly some sort of deal is being worked out between Gorbachev and Kohl.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, something is being worked out.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is all being taking place during the Bush administration, let us not forget. With their own peculiar history of friendliness to a certain group of goose steppers.
Oh, they're in so tight. Absolutely.
They're in so tight. I mean, you know, talk about timing.
It is really amazing. And you make that excellent point that George Bush Sr. is president during the reunification of Germany.
Yep.
And we can see there are blatant ties through his father, Senator Prescott Bush, to Nazi Germany.
Exactly.
And, you know, doing business with them at one point, even being exposed by FDR's administration for doing business with the Nazis. It's really quite a telling thing that Bush is there at this time.
This is not coincidental. It can't be.
And the reunification really can't happen without America.
It can't happen without the tacit permission of Washington, you know. So if something's going on, there's clearly something going on. And the real question is, even if that Czech publication is not true, there is something going on. What is giving Germany the military leverage against the Soviet Union to get the Soviets to dismantle the entire post-war system of alliances and puppet states that they built up for their own security? There's something huge. There's a huge question mark that has never been answered, ever, to this day. I'll tell you what my suspicion is. If you go back to that period of time and recall what was happening inside the Soviet Union, not in terms of collapsing economy, not in terms of the KGB being fed up with the Communist Party and so on and so forth. If you look at the earthquakes inside the Soviet Union, they are suspiciously close to the German reunification, and they're in Georgia, big ones. And where is the Soviet foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, from? Well, he's from Georgia, okay? So I'm wondering if maybe some sort of exotic, it looks like an act of God, but it ain't, technology was in play there. I just have to wonder.
Intriguing. Yeah. They obviously had something to use as leverage that must have been so compelling. As we know, the Russians were a serious superpower with nuclear weapons.
Gobs of them.
So how do you threaten a nuclear country?
Well, there is the problem, and I pointed this out in the third way, that recently, in the last year and a half, I think it was, France tested its new submarine-launched ballistic missile successfully. So let us not forget, folks, the crazy French could press the button and blow up the United States if they wanted to.
All right.
But you dig into this, and you discover that these missiles have MIRV warheads, three warheads, of about 200 to 300, it's suspected, of about 200 to 300 kilotons yield. In other words, big.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you dig into it. Guess who's building the missile?
Who is it?
The Germans.
Wow.
Guess who's building the warheads?
Oh, no. Is it the Germans?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
So, okay, now wait a minute. Wait, and this was exposed on a pro-Russian internet website. So, in other words, the Russians are saying, it ain't the French building these. You know, the French are launching them. They've got the tricolor on them. But who's building them? You know, it's the Germans. So you have, as I've long suspected with Germany, you have a de facto nuclear power.
Right.
That everybody knows is a nuclear power, but we're not really going to talk about
it. It's completely under the radar. We'll
keep everybody happy. You know, imagine the reaction in Europe if all of a sudden, oh, the Germans are now officially a nuclear power. There'd be a little bit of an outcry, I think. You know?
Oh, this is really interesting because you've shown that the post-war Nazi international was probably responsible for setting up South Africa and Israel with nukes.
Oh, of course. This is the old, if we've got treaty obligations, then we'll get what we need in terms of weaponry and advanced technology through proxies. We'll just simply farm it outside of Germany through all of our corporate contacts and let somebody else do it with German technology. So we build the bomb, they test the bomb, and we have the bomb. Okay. Now, what happened in South Africa's case and Israel's case is that during the early 1960s, the German military, and again, you have to dig to find this bit of information out, but it's there. The German military just very bluntly said, it's ridiculous to be a world power. Hear the repeat of Versailles going on here, folks. It's ridiculous to be a major military and economic power squat in the middle of Europe, surrounded by the French, surrounded by the British, and surrounded by the Russians, and we can't defend ourselves. So we've got to have an independent German nuclear deterrent. But our treaty provisions prevent us from doing this on German soil. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to the other pariah nation in the world, South Africa, with a horrible, abominable regime.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And you know, they've got the uranium. We've got the uranium enrichment capability. We've got the scientists. And, oh, by the way, the Israelis want a bomb, too, and they've got lots of American money. So, you know, there's your deal right there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Germans in South Africa in the 60s and 70s helping the South Africans acquire their atomic bomb technology. It's German technology. The South Africans are supplying the uranium, and we're siphoning off a little bit of it to be hijacked. This is very clever, to be hijacked on shipments by Israelis described as terrorists.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, Israel's getting cut in on the deal, too. So everybody's happy. And, you know, the Carter administration people may not remember, accused the South Africans of having tested an atomic bomb because American spy satellites caught what apparently was a test in 1979. Most people don't remember this. The Carter administration accused South Africa of having a bomb, and South Africa very cleverly said, no, we don't, because it wasn't their bomb.
It was somebody else's bomb.
It was somebody else's bomb. We were just there to help.
Right. Well, that whole black market nuclear development is very murky and dangerous. And the idea of Germany with nukes is just a scary prospect, no doubt about it. Uh-huh. Joseph, this has just been outstanding. The new book is The Third Way, and it's available now at GizaDeathStar.com. That's the preferable way to get it. This new book is so interesting and informative. I can't recommend it enough.
Thank you.
It's excellent having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, if you have a little extra time, I want to talk to you off air about setting up part three on this. And that will bring in CERN, the deep politics aspect, and your Giza Death Star work all together. So can you stick around for that?
Hey, look, I have it right over there on my book. Daniel List, time for discussion afterwards, is put in parentheses under it.
Yeah, good going. You knew it was going to happen.
I knew it was going to happen.
Thank you for joining me for this powerful episode with Dr. Joseph P. Farrell on the rise of the New Reich and Deep State America. You can find more special reports, in-depth interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to get the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.